E. Michael Jones and I, he's been very gracious in sparing his time today on Bank Holiday Monday in Britain, the day after Easter Sunday, and to talk about his book, latest book, The Holocaust Narrative. How are the book sales doing, Mr.
Good.
Jones?
We're doing very well. It's the book, the right time for this book to come out, because the Holocaust narrative is basically the hidden grammar of the American Empire, and the American Empire is falling apart now, as Immanuel Toth said in his book, La Défaite l'Occident. And so, when things fall apart, you have to look and go to the basis of what you believe, and it turns out that it's a an idol with feet of clay.
Could I stop you there? You mentioned a Frenchman. Could you explain a little bit more about who he was and everything?
Yeah, he just wrote a book, as I mentioned. It's called Le Défaite de l'Occident. It's not been translated into English yet. But the premise of the book is that the American Empire is falling apart, which I think is true. But then he goes on to say that the reason for this is because the hidden grammar of the American Empire is Protestantism. And he said that during this period of time, Protestantism has evaporated. And I think that's true as well. I think that's true as well.
And this Frenchman, he's Catholic, isn't he?
No, he's a Jew. He's a Jew. And that's part of the problem that he has, identifying the problem, because the Jews, it turns out, are the problem. And he can't really see that because he's one of them. It's like asking, I said this before, asking a fish, are you wet? No, the fish doesn't know it's wet because he's completely immersed in that environment. And
It
so the
wants
Jew,
to be wet. It wants to be wet, or it'll die.
it doesn't know anything else. I mean, maybe it jumps out of the water for a little bit and it knows that's its element and doesn't really think about the element. That's the situation the Jews are in our culture right now. Yuri Slezkind wrote a book called The Jewish Century, which he says is the 20th century, where they basically took over the culture of the West. And so the defeat of the West is going to be the defeat of the Jews in some sense or other. And that's precisely the blind spot in this book, which is otherwise a worthwhile book. If, I mean, given the fact that he's a Frenchman, the Frenchmen love to talk about America. Ever since Crèvecoeur came over here, Lafayette came over here, they love to talk about America, but they never understand it because they don't. So you can say that Protestantism is the hidden grammar of America, but then you have to ask the question, what's the hidden grammar of Protestantism? And that's,
Rebellion from Catholicism, surely.
no, it's Satanism. Satan, I don't know whether you saw this, but I just had a big discussion with Kevin Barrett, who is now a Muslim, who interestingly, this is what he latched onto when he read my book, my review of the book, Toth's book, because he was raised as a Unitarian. So there was a moment when we were in Tehran together, he was telling me about his life and how he was raised as a Unitarian, how he became a Muslim. And I said, well, you just added camels to your Unitarianism. And everybody thought that was funny. And he used that as the theme to introduce what we were talking about here, because he was raised, his grandmother was a devout Emersonian. And Ralph Waldo Emerson is a crucial figure if you want to understand the evolution of what it means to be an American. Paul Johnson said he was the first American. Now, there were people over, we're talking about the middle of the 19th century. There were obviously people over here before that, but they were all Englishmen. If you're talking about the New England colonies, they were
Could you please,
Englishmen who
would
were
you
living.
explain for the benefit of people not familiar with Emersonianism, what it
Okay,
means?
so Emerson. So you had this, let's begin with Protestantism. Okay. Protestantism was a rebellion against the Catholic Church. It's that simple. What is the essence of Protestantism? Is it the Bible? A lot of people say it's the Bible. You can interpret the Bible as you see fit. Sola Scriptura was one of the pillars of Lutheranism. No, the Bible's Catholic. They took that from the Catholic Church. So what did they add to it? You know, it was like Kevin added camels to his Unitarianism. What did the Protestants add to the Bible? Rebellion. Rebellion. That is the essence of Protestantism. And it's never going to change. And the man who really understood this was John Milton, who wrote the Protestant epic, which is Paradise Lost. And the hero of the Protestant epic is Satan. This was the big revelation that took place in England during the Romantic era. Blake was the first man. William Blake was the first man to understand this. Satan is the hero of Paradise Lost. Shelley understood that. He was a revolutionary. And I think they were both right. Satan is the hero of Paradise Lost. Satanism is the hidden grammar of Protestantism. And that's what these were the people that came to America. So if you read, Samuel Huntington wrote a book around 2000 called Who Are We? He's a WASP a professor of something or other at Harvard, kind of the official spokesman, the mind of America. And he said, who are we? We are Anglo-Protestants. Okay, that's it. So I don't really fit in. I'm a Catholic. You wouldn't fit in. Kevin Barrett doesn't fit in. But we all have to adopt to this paradigm.
Because of WASP supremacy, when would you say it began?
With the Puritans. So he says, okay, that Protestantism is the essence of America. Puritanism is the essence of Protestantism. And I'm saying Satanism is the essence of Puritanism. So you're talking about these crazy Englishmen who left England in the wake, right around the time of the revolution, the Puritan revolution, where they murdered the king. It's a real revolution. You have to murder the king. The regicide was one of the regicides was John Milton. He was the third one to sign the death warrant of the king. And he understood the essence of Puritanism, which was rebellion. And that's why Satan is the hero of Paradise Lost. You read that speech. Okay, so obviously, Paradise Lost. It begins with the fall of the angels. The angels have rebelled against God. Satan is the chief rebel here. And he wakes up in a sea of flame, and it's hell. And he says, what are we going to do now? And he comes up with a plan. And the plan is basically to destroy humanity by tempting Eve and corrupting Adam. That's the big plan. That's in the future. But now he's got to rally the troops, and he comes to him and he says, the mind is its own place. It's better to reign in hell than to serve in heaven. Here we will be free. Arise, awake, or be forever fallen. I'm saying this was the paradigm that those English Puritans carried into the new world. Here we shall be free. It's better to reign in Massachusetts than serve in England. Okay, that's the beginning. Now, Huntington makes an important point in his book because he says there's a difference between settlers and immigrants. Settlers are the first people there, and they create the form, and immigrants conform to that paradigm. And that is the story of the United States. And so what you had was a group of people coming to the United States who were set the form, and they were the Puritans. There were other people here, but they were all infected with Calvinism, even the people in Virginia who were nominally Anglicans. It led to a civil war where basically Massachusetts conquered Virginia. And the man who was the representative of that in the 19th century was Ralph Waldo Emerson. And the main cause, his political cause, was abolition, and it led to the Civil War. And that led to
abolition of what? I'm afraid.
Abolition of slavery.
But that was after. So he was. Okay. He was. He lived in the time of the American Civil War, and he wanted to abolish slavery. But I still don't understand Satanism or Paradise Lost. According to Wikipedia, it's all about redemption through Jesus Christ, yes. After the temptation of Adam and Eve. So I don't see the connection between that and Satan winning.
Because
you're saying Protestantism is Satanism.
Yes. Yes, because it's basically the key thing is rebellion. And that's what the Protestants brought to the Catholic Church, the rebellion against the Catholic Church.
And but could it not be said that Protestantism was inevitable? It could not have been prevented because the kings would say, well, I'm not going to listen to you anymore, Pope, because, you know, you're just a man. You're not God. Yes,
because we speak English, we have a natural tendency to believe something called Whig history, which is basically the English Whigs created this fiction called history in which the primary value is freedom. And Protestantism was a justification, justified itself because it brought freedom to the dark Middle Ages. This eventually morphed into the Enlightenment. And these are the cliches and the paradigms that rule the mind of English-speaking people, both in England and America.
And what should have ruled their minds?
An accurate understanding of the Reformation, which is basically, number one, what is the cause of the Reformation? The cause of the Reformation is lust, the vice of lust. Okay, you know what that is, right? Sexual sin.
You mean Henry VIII lusting after a woman?
That is certainly important in England, but the really important person in this regard is Luther. The Reformation began in Germany with a horny priest by the name of Martin Luther, who had very little ability to control his passions, whether it was lust, which I mentioned, or gluttony or anger. He just could not control his passions. And so he rebelled against the church, and at a certain point, he's living off in the Wartburg. He's got nothing to do. And the passions take control of them. So what were the Lutherans doing at this point? They were breaking into convents and taking the women out and basically offering them like pimps to other priests who, if you get the wife, if you are willing to join the Reformed Party. Luther offered the best looking nun to the Bishop of Mainz if he would join the Lutheran Party. All of the Lutheran reformers have this in common, and Luther was the classic example. So it's one thing to be unable to control your passions, but at a certain point, that takes over your mind.
So Luther was offering Catholic nuns as booty for men who fought in the Protestant cause. But right. I thought the Reformation began because Martin Luther objected to the selling of indulgences.
That's right. And that's called Whig history. Okay, so yeah, if you want to buy into Whig history, be my guest. But that's not the cause of the revolution. If you want my take on indulgences and the role it played in the Reformation, read my book, Barren Metal, which is about economics. And that's what that's about. And there is, I'm getting to it, but I mean, there is an economic cause to the revolution, to the Protestant revolution as well. But I will get to that. But back to Luther. Luther, at a certain point, can't control his passions. So he decides, I have to marry, better to marry than to burn. And he marries a nun called Katharina von Bora. At this point, he decides to come up with a theological justification for his inability to control his passions. And it's called the enslaved will, De Servo Arbitrio, written right after he jumped ship and married this nun. He broke solemn vows of celibacy, as did the nun. And now they have to come up with a justification. And he said, hey, God did it. I didn't do it. That's the beginning of Protestant theology. Calvin took it over as predestination. And that's what they brought to Massachusetts with them. Crazy idea. You're totally depraved and you have no choice in the matter. And this is how these Puritans are supposed to make sense of this huge forest. That's the fundamental problem. But I can get back to
you reject predestination. Is that what you're saying? Predestination is anti-God?
I accept predestination as the Catholics understand it, which means that it does not eliminate free will. there is a predestination that takes account of free will, and that's the distinguishing between the Calvinist version and the Islamic version. There are a lot of similarities between nominalism, which is the philosophical school that Luther was raised in, and Islam, in the sense that you have no understanding of the mind of God, and your duty is just total submission to an inscrutable God. They have those things in common. That's in effect the God that Luther imposed on German Christians at this time. And Calvin is the man who brought.
I was going to ask you what you found objectionable about the Calvinist view of predestination.
All right, let me give you the Catholic view, okay? Mm-hmm. All right, and I'm going to give you an anecdote from my life.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I'm taking a walk in May, okay, I'm coming to the St. Joseph River. There's a bridge across the St. Joseph River, and the river is flooding, which it often does in the spring. I'm crossing the bridge, and there is a woman, black woman, coming to me, and she walks up to me, and she says, "Do you have a cell phone?" And I said, "No, I don't. I'm the only guy in South Bend that doesn't have a cell phone." She says, "Well, I need to call my mama because I'm going to kill myself." And at that point, she hops over the railing of the bridge, and she's standing on the ledge, and she's ready to jump into the river. I guess she couldn't swim. Even if she could swim, she'd probably die. And so I spent the next, half an hour trying to persuade her not to kill herself.
Mm-hmm.
I said, "God has a plan for your life." And then I said a prayer. And God answered my prayer. The cop showed up. The cop talked her off the bridge, and she got in a cop car, and I never saw her again. Now, let me explain to you what happened there. God predestined that from all eternity, that I was going to meet that woman on that bridge. Because if I had left 5 minutes earlier or 5 minutes later, I never would have met her. We never would have had this conversation. She might have killed herself. I would have never known about it. Now, that was predestined. There's nothing I can do about that. Mm-hmm. I was created, in a sense, to be there at that time by God. Now, when I got there, I had total free will. I could have said, "Tough luck, honey. Go jump. I'll see you later." Or she could have said, "Ain't no white motherfucker going to tell me what to do," and jumped in the river. She could have done that too. But it didn't happen because we both had free will. God created us, predestined us to be together, but he created us with the free will that we could either do good or evil at that moment. That's the relationship between God's predestination and our free will, and it's not in Calvinism. Calvinism would say basically the lady was predestined to jump in the river or not to jump in the river, and what I had to say had nothing to do with it. No, my rational explanation had something to do with the fact that she did not jump in the river. My prayer had something to do with that. That is completely missing from Puritan Massachusetts, and it doesn't work. It does not work. Because these are people now, they left everything behind, and now they're in the middle of a wilderness, and they have to survive the winter, which means you have to have human effort here. How are you going to do that? That's the whole story of America, how the idea of the American personality developed from this crazy Calvinism coming in contact with the forest, the wilderness, and evolving a character that is known as the American.
Yes. So, but why is it so important? In that you can understand the American character without understanding predestination as you have described it. White people arrived in America and they had a different life to the, white people in the old world, and because things were different in the new world and they interacted with their environment and eventually took it all over.
You cannot understand America in the 17th century in Massachusetts without understanding Calvin and his doctrine of predestination and innate depravity. It's impossible. You cannot understand what's going on unless you understand that.
I see. I thought Calvin was popular because he said usury was okay, while Luther was very firmly against usury. But somehow Calvin managed to say, oh, a little bit of usury is not really usury.
That was an important break with Luther. Luther was totally against usury. Luther was a much more traditional Christian than Calvin was in that regard. But Calvin allowed usury. He was from the French-speaking part of Switzerland, which was heavily involved in banking, and that's why he became popular there, and that Geneva became the headquarters of Calvinism.
Didn't he have to flee from France after the revolution or something? Oh, no, sorry, that was before the revolution. He lived before the French Revolution, that's right, yes.
Right, yeah, you did. The Huguenots were the Frenchmen who converted to Calvinism, and they were persecuted. The part of Whig history is an exaggeration of St. Bartholomew's Day, where the French king just murdered a number of Huguenots. You could make the case, as in the English Reformation, or that these people were, by the fact that they were Calvinists, they were revolutionaries, and so therefore they were a danger to the state, and they deserved to be have some type of criminal sanction put on them.
Calvinists rejected the established church. Was that the problem with them?
Calvin was a revolution. This is the beginning of the infiltration of the Jewish revolutionary spirit into Europe. This is where it made major inroads. By the time you had got to the Puritans, which was the Puritan Revolution by the middle of the 17th century, you had a significant group of people that seized power in a coup d'etat. These people were Judaizers. Everybody knows that Puritans were Judaizers. They were Christians who ate pork. Because they discredited the Catholic Church as the authority, they had to find it somewhere else. They found it in the Old Testament. Classic example is John Milton, again, the author of Paradise Lost. He wrote a tract on divorce. So he marries this woman. The woman suddenly realizes life is not going to be fun married to John Milton. So she went back to her family where they had parties and so on and so forth. And he was upset and he decided, wait a minute, that other lady, look, she looks kind of attractive. I think I'll marry her. But wait a minute, I can't do that. Well, wait a minute. Yes, I can. Well, what does the gospel say? What does Jesus? Does Jesus have something to say about divorce? Oh, wait a minute. He said it was wrong. Okay, well, the hell with that. Let's go back to Moses said it was okay. This is the whole project of the Judaizer, to break away from what Jesus Christ said, to break away from the Catholic Church that Jesus Christ founded, and create a Puritan theocracy, which is very similar to the state of Israel. And what do they have in common? The idea of Amalek. Amalek means I can kill you. So Amalek is taken from the Bible when Joshua enters Canaan, and then it morphs into the Puritan conqueror of Ireland, Cromwell, who says the Irish are Amalek, and so therefore you can exterminate them. And then the English come to America, these Puritans, and then they say, oh, the Indians are Amalek, so we can exterminate them too.
I was going to say, Ann Coulter lives in a place, or grew up in a place called New Canaan, didn't she? There is a place in America called New Canaan.
Right, absolutely, absolutely. It's in Connecticut, and this is one of the hotbeds of Puritan culture in America. The Connecticut River Valley was the source of the Great Awakening, which was a psychological reaction to Puritanism that took place in the middle of the 18th century, 1740. But yeah, that's an example of that. Or, you know, Salem, Massachusetts. These are all people giving names to places because they were now God's chosen people. We are the Hebrews. This is what the Puritans said when they got over there. We are God's chosen people. This is Canaan. This is the land of milk and honey, and we're going to conquer it, and we're going to exterminate everyone of the natives. That's the mindset that these Puritans brought to America.
I see, but isn't it just
Claire, hold on, stop. Yeah, you must have moved away from the microphone or something. I can't hear you. Yeah, that's better.
Okay. I was going to say.
No, you're still away. You got to do something. Move to the microphone.
Well, I haven't moved it away. I'm still at my desk. I'm sorry about that, but I mean, I can see that my avatar pulsating. Are there still audio issues, Mike? No, you can't hear me now?
I it's just going in and out. Sometimes I can hear you and sometimes I can't.
Oh, dear.
Is that better?
All right, say something, Claire.
Testing.
That's fine. So stay wherever you are, okay?
Okay, I haven't moved at all. I'm okay. Sitting very, very still at my desk. And we were talking about the Puritans. And yes, supersessionism. This seems to be, you know, what happened to the Jews. I believe the Catholic Church called themselves God's people, and I guess the Anglicans also called themselves God's people, and people and different religions have been saying, no, Jews, you're no longer the chosen people. We are. And right. This has, you know, happened over the centuries to them and to those who claim to supersede them. Ending right. with the Muslims, yes. I guess.
The church is the new Israel. That is called supersessionism. So Judaism ended as a religion when Jesus Christ was crucified. The veil in the temple was torn apart. And just to make sure that the Jews got the message, the Romans came in and destroyed the temple in 70 AD. So at this point, there is no way to fulfill the Mosaic covenant. You have to have a priesthood, a temple, and a sacrifice. You can't have that anymore. The temple's destroyed, and the Catholic Church now has the priesthood. The temple is Jesus Christ, and the sacrifice is the Mass. And the Catholic Church is now the new Israel. This is the fulfillment of God's promise to the Hebrew people. The Jews, when Jesus Christ arrived on this earth, he was the Jewish Messiah, and they had to accept this new dispensation on his terms and not their terms. And so we just finished Holy Week, where we commemorate the fact that the Jews united, the Jewish people, not all Jews, the Jewish people united against Jesus Christ and murdered him. And that was the turning point in human history.
I thought when the great Sanhedrin was disbanded in 425, that was when Judaism ceased to be an organized religion, because it basically lost its head, you know, in the same way that
the Sanhedrin was the ruling body of the Jews, but the temple sacrifice was the essence of the Mosaic covenant, and that ceased with the destruction of the temple. They could no longer perform the ritual sacrifice that was essential to their religion.
Yes, so it seems that you know, Judaism has not been an organized religion for centuries and centuries and centuries, and therefore that's why you get the problem of two Jews, three opinions, and you can never get them to agree, and even Jews, you know, shop around for a rabbi whose opinion agrees with their preference, and it's impossible to deal with them because they will never agree, and there's so many different kinds of Jews, and well, there will be, you know, good Jews and bad Jews, and Jews who want to assimilate and Jews who want to pretend to be Jews and have the best of both worlds. You know, in the sense that we have this phenomenon of cultural Christian. A cultural Christian doesn't believe in the Trinity. He somehow sees himself as entitled to claim Christian identity, but without actually believing or understanding principles.
Yeah, the two Jews, three opinions is obsolete now. What we saw recently, crucial moment in recent American history, is the overturning of Roe versus Wade by the Dobbs decision. At this point, 400 Jewish organizations came out and said that abortion is a fundamental Jewish value.
This they wouldn't be Orthodox. They would be Reform, surely.
Doesn't matter. It doesn't matter.
They are considered to be heretics. by the Orthodox community, and they're too afraid to even say that of their own people.
Doesn't matter. I mean, I said this to Ben Shapiro when he was in South Bend at the Right to Life banquet, and he said, they're not Jews. Well, wait a minute. You are not the Jewish Pope. This is majority rules now, and there is a group of people called the Jews, and they're mobilized around certain key concepts and key organizations. So there's no Sanhedrin anymore, but there are major Jewish organizations like the ADL, like IPAC, the World Jewish Congress, the American Jewish Congress.
But they're run by Gentiles. They are controlled by Gentiles. I mean, the ADL is an arm of the CIA, surely.
No, I'm sorry. You've got the tail wagging the dog here. The ADL is not a tool of the CIA. I guarantee you that. If you want to go back to a certain crucial moment in history, you could talk about the AJC, the American Jewish Committee, collaborating with the FBI during the McCarthy era and handing over the names of Jewish communists to the FBI. But the AJC never was an adjunct of the FBI. No, that's never been the case, and it's never been the case with the CIA either.
Oh, I seem to remember Jonathan Greenblatt boasting that he was embedded in social media platforms and also worked hand in glove with the CIA.
Hand in glove with the CIA, it does not mean you are part of the CIA. There's always the whole point of this after World War II, to get back to the Holocaust narrative, which enabled the Jewish takeover of America. Okay. The whole point of this is that they were junior partners at the time of World War II. The WASP elite still had control of America. And the classic example was the Morgenthau Plan. The Jew Morgenthau was Secretary of Treasury, had enormous power over Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and he had a plan to starve Germany to death, deindustrialization. And that plan was put into effect during the summer of, or the winter of 46, 47, when Germany was starving to death. At this point, the WASP elite, which still existed at that point, stepped in, and people like Herbert Hoover, former president, said, this is Semitic vengeance. This is not what we believe. Who is this we? It's the Protestant American consciousness, the WASP elite. And they pulled the plug on Morgenthau, and they told the Jews to, you know, forget it. And they instituted the Marshall Plan, and that saved Germany. Now, the difference between then and now is we have total Jewish control over our political process. The Biden administration is run by 457 Jews. There is no WASP elite anymore. The closest we have it is Tucker Carlson, who has a talk show. Colonel McGregor. These are people who are kind of the remnants of that WASP elite with no political, not, let's put it this way, not enough political power to contradict the Jews, to veto Jewish plans. And so what you have now is Benjamin Netanyahu running amok in Israel, murdering Palestinians, and no one can seem to stop him. Now, there's pushback now. The United States, it's partially the Biden Jews now are objecting to the Likud Jews. And they have to say, look, Bibi, you're making Jews look bad. You can't go on this way. But there's a fundamental difference between that and after World War II, when we had a WASP elite who could just say, you know, forget it.
But you seem to be saying that the division amongst Christians, the division between Catholic and Protestants, has allowed Jews to exploit their divisions. Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely. You're absolutely right. Absolutely right. And Europe has never recovered from the Reformation. It has been divided ever since. It had a big, you know, outburst of power toward the end of the 19th century, but it has never recovered from the Reformation. Christendom was divided at that point. And the first people to notice this were the Turks. This is when Luther started saying, Islam is die Peitsche Gottes. Islam is the scourge of God. So the Protestants are fighting with the Catholics. And what's the first symptom? The Turks start marching up the Danube. and the Turks are going to take Vienna. And finally, they say, well, wait a minute, stop. Okay, we're going to stop fighting. We have to fight the Turks now. And so the crucial moment came in, what, 1685, when the Turks are basically at the door of Vienna. It's memorialized in Lord of the Rings. This is the battle over Minas Tirith. And they're finally saved by the Polish cavalry. Christendom is saved by the Polish cavalry. But this is a manifestation of the split, the crucial split in Europe that basically destroyed it. And it's the crucial split that is destroying America right now.
But having had a look at the different religions, it seems that Christianity is not codified, and therefore you can't really get any Christian to list a set of principles, and they're bound to disagree. And I think it's the uncodified nature of Christianity that causes all these divisions. Because in Judaism, they have the 13 principles of Judaism, 7 Noahic laws, 10 commandments, you know, but these are, you know, lists of things that you can easily remember. But Christians, well, 7 deadly sins, but it doesn't really help Christians know what the rules are.
Claire, you're crippled by the fact that you're speaking from England. You're English, because you've got a completely distorted understanding of Christianity, because England is a completely distorted version of Christianity. If there's ever a religion that has secure principles based on 1,000 years of brilliant theologians, and more importantly, a secure metaphysical base in reason, it is the Catholic Church. And you've inherited all of the anti-Catholic bigotry simply by being English, by speaking English. It just has taken over your mind. It's taken over the mind of many Catholics as well, so don't feel bad.
But many Englishmen in the 50s converted to Catholicism.
Right.
Those who were Anglican, like Waugh and a few others whose name I can't remember, but I know that Malcolm Muggeridge was this Labour MP, and he wrote The End of Christendom, which was published in 1980. And it seems to me that many Europeans hadn't noticed that Christendom ended in over 100 years ago. And that Christianity
there are always,
to protect the divine right of kings.
It's never going to stop. I mean, Jews are converting to Catholicism. Englishmen are converting to Catholicism. Apparently, Candace Owen, to get back to the lady of the hour right now, her husband is a convert to Catholicism. He's an English aristocrat of some sort or other. Jordan Peterson is just now on EWTN being grilled about, well, your wife converted, why don't you convert to Catholicism? It's the existential question. Are you going to accept Jesus Christ? Are you going to say Christ is king? Or are you going to say crucify him? That is the fundamental existential question of the West. And it's the same question today.
Well, it's a question of choosing the best religion, and America doesn't have an official religion. And if you go back to Christianity, it would be un-American because of the separation of church and state.
First of all, separation of church and state is not in the Constitution. It is an exaggeration of something. But let's accept it for what it is. This was the crucial moment in this debate that took place about the Daily Wire. Now, for America to exist, there has to be a consensus, but it cannot be a state religion. We all know that, okay? Now, what is it then? It's the moral order. John Adams said, we have no constitution that functions in the absence of a moral people. Irving Kristol, the father of neoconservatism, said the basis of America is Judeo-Christian morality. Okay, well, guess what, Irving? There is no such thing as Judeo-Christian morality. The Jews just proved that by saying abortion is a fundamental Jewish value. Apparently, Ben Shapiro hasn't gotten the message. Okay, he still thinks that there's Judeo-Christian morality out there. I tried to bring it to his attention personally, but he just dismissed me in his kind of cavalier, snarky Jewish way. This is what the crisis of last week was. You have Candace Owen, Christian lady, in a debate with the rabbi, this condescending, unctuous rabbi who's trying to talking to Candace Owens as if she's this idiot child. I don't know, is she a Schwarzer or is she a Schicksal? Either way, the culminating point of it comes when Candace Owens says, "You can't impose your religion on me." That is exactly what happened. That is the end of conservatism. That is the end of Judeo-Christian morality. And there is no possibility of unity anymore in America, because now we realize that the Jews have been trying to impose their religion on us in the name of feminism, in the name of Zionism, whatever the ism is. It's really the Jews imposing their religion on Christianity. That's blown up. Conservatism is over. Ben Shapiro can go on. I'm sure they have lots of money at the Daily Wire, but it's over, Ben. There's no such thing. It's either you crucify him or Christ is king. That's what happened this Holy Week.
But Mike, aren't you conflating Jews with liberalism when you talk about abortion as a right? There's nothing, there's no authority for that in Jewish scripture. And if any Jew were to say that, it would be a liberal Jew.
Stop. Who are you to determine what Jewish tradition is? Who are you to determine what the Jews say is a fundamental value? You have no right to do this. I have no right to do this. No one has a right to do this other than the Jews, and the Jews have chosen their fundamental right. They nailed their colors to the mast, and what I'm saying here is if abortion is a fundamental right for your religion, you are not worshiping Yahweh. You are worshiping
the heretics. These would be Reformed Jews. I'm sure the Orthodox community would not be agreeing that abortion is a fundamental human right.
Doesn't matter. Ben Shapiro doesn't agree either. Doesn't matter. Charles Moskowitz doesn't agree. They don't count. The Jews have said this. The Jews are a political entity.
As represented by whom and which organization?
I've already told you. The modern day Sanhedrin is the American Jewish Committee. It's major Jewish organizations. That is the Sanhedrin. These are the people who speak for Jews.
But these are secular Jews. And Gentiles can take away their
Doesn't
power.
Matter. Doesn't matter.
By ignoring all the secular Jews and going straight
Doesn't
to the
matter.
Orthodox rabbis.
If you're talking about the Jews, first of all, there are plenty of Orthodox operations that would agree with the abortion thing. I think Orthodox organizations have signed on to this thing. I've talked to Rabbi David Weiss. I was in Mashhad with him, and we talked, you know. I said to the people there, I said, if all the Jews were like Rabbi Weiss, we wouldn't be here. We wouldn't have a problem. He's content to live in a ghetto. It's called Netarai Karta. They think that Zionism is an abomination. That's fine. But that group of people is the exception which proves the rule. And the rule is major Jewish organizations determine what the Jews say. And the Jews have said that abortion is a fundamental Jewish value. And we cannot change that. And Ben Shapiro, with all his money, cannot change that fact. And now, because of that, there is no such thing as Judeo-Christian morality, which means there's no such thing as conservatism, which means there's no such thing as America. America is based on a shared moral consensus. If we don't have this, we don't have America.
At the very least, the moral authority would be supporting marriage. And we know that American laws do not support marriage at all. It's giving us, you know, marriage substitutes, fornication, sodomy, right. gay right. marriage, etc. And I think that is really the problem. And the idea of free love has become sacred, and this enormous idol that completely obscures even Christianity, Judaism, or Islam.
Right. The fundamental crisis now, the fundamental turning point in American history was the abandonment of sexual morality and morality in general. If once you abandon morality, there is no consensus here. And I'm saying morality goes from A to Z. It goes from abortion to Zionism. And the fundamental crisis in Gaza right now is a moral crisis. You have people who are saying that we don't have to follow the moral. This is the law of all of humanity, and we don't have to follow it because we're special. We're Jews. And you can't tell us what to do. And so we can kill babies in the womb, and it's a Jewish sacrament. And if you try to prevent that, you're infringing on our religion. And we can kill babies with F-16s, and that's called Zionism. And this has put the Jews beyond the pale of civilization. Now, people who are beyond the pale, pale, they're posts nailed in the ground. Okay, that's the borderline between civilization and barbarism. And the Jews have placed themselves outside of the pale. Now, we have to draw the proper conclusions now. The fundamental political issue in both Europe and the United States is Jewish control of our culture, Jewish control, Jewish tyranny. Let's call a spade a spade. It's Jewish tyranny. Where what do you find now if you're Candace Owen or Kanye West, you can have black privilege until you say something against the Jews, and then they will destroy you. No one should have this right. And until we take back the rights that we have as Americans, guaranteed by the Constitution, we are an enslaved people suffering under tyrants. And that doesn't sit well with Americans.
But surely the only way to take back power for white, Gentile Westerners to take back power is to respect the institution of marriage again. In your book, Libido Dominandi, you were saying that sexual liberation is political enslavement or words to that effect.
That's right. You're absolutely right. And that's that. And who were the architects of sexual liberation? The Jews. So you take it up to the right last minute. Rabbi Shmuley. If Rabbi Shmuley didn't exist, Adolf Hitler would have to create him to make people hate Jews. Okay. So he has a debate with Alex Jones. And what does he say? Alex Jones is sexually repressed. He needs to buy one of my butt plugs or something like this. He actually said this. I'm not making this up. Where is that? What is the gospel that he's preaching? Is that the Torah? No. Is that the Talmud? It's not even the Talmud. What is it? It's Wilhelm Reich. It is the mass psychology of fascism. That is the gospel that Rabbi Shmuley is preaching.
But he's a TV rabbi and obviously considered to be more powerful than any Orthodox rabbi. Because if you're a TV rabbi, you know people will have heard of you and just assume that your word is king, while you know some unheard of Orthodox rabbi completely ignored. It is the media.
Rabbi Shmuley is the most famous Jew in the world right now. There is no question. There is no election. Okay, the Jews do not have a pope. They wish they did, I think. So I keep telling Charles Moskowitz when he says, oh, he's not really a Jew. Well, I said, are you the Jewish Pope? No, they don't have a Pope. And so whoever's popular is the big Jew. And the big Jew at this point, big Jew was Alan Dershowitz for a while. Now he got in trouble with Jason Epstein. So he's not the big Jew anymore. The big Jew at this moment in time is Rabbi Shmuley.
But Mike, these big Jews are crowned by liberal Gentile media. It's the perception of Gentiles who say it's this Jew who's more popular or more listened to, and it's not based on any moral authority. It's whatever's popular at the moment.
You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. He has no moral authority whatsoever. The Jews have no moral authority whatsoever. They've already proven that. It's time to draw the conclusions that have to be drawn. Okay, do you want to be ruled by Rabbi Shmuley? Do you want this man to have the power to ruin your life, which is what he did to Candace Owen? Candace Owen has a lot of money. She's married to a very wealthy guy. She's going to land on her feet and so on and so forth. But that doesn't change the fact that 2 years ago or something like that, Rabbi Shmuley sent out on a crusade to drive her out of the Daily Wire. Who gave these people the power to destroy our lives? How long are we going to tolerate these people's power to destroy our lives?
But isn't this how empires are run? Divide and rule. And I suppose if the American Empire stands for anything, it is for the noble motive of protecting, you know, Jews in Israel from people who want to exterminate them. And this remains the narrative. Jews have been made the mascot of the Anglo-Saxon Empire. And these divisions are deliberately created in the West so that the government can divide and rule us by race.
Right.
You're right.
I am not disagreeing with you. As I said before, this crucial transformation took place after World War II. And if you want to understand how it happened, read the Holocaust narrative. That's my latest book. The Holocaust narrative explains how this story got turned into political power. Okay, because you have to have the narrative before you have the power. And so the first expression of a political power was this creation of the State of Israel. That could not have happened without the Holocaust narrative. It allowed the Jewish terrorist from, you know, like Menachem Begin, the Stern Gang, Irgun, to come in and slaughter innocent Palestinians in places like Deir Yassin, the ethnic cleansing and extermination of that. Now, the image in the back of their mind was Amalek. Of course it was. It was their perverted reading of the Old Testament that allowed them to do that. But the proximate cause that allowed them to do that was the Holocaust narrative. They were the junior partners, the Eisenhower, who needed justification for his own war crimes, needed Hollywood. Billy Wilder was the man for the Hollywood director, the Jew. His name is Shmuel Wilder. They brought him in to do the film that became known as Death Mills, the propaganda film that launched the Holocaust narrative. And over the period of time, the narrative became so effective that basically the Jews took over, which is where we are today. What are we going to do about the Jewish takeover of our culture? Are we, England, let's take England as a good example. Cunning of reason. This is what Hegel called it. So the Jews bring all these Muslims in to basically destroy the unity of English culture. But wait a minute. It turns out that the Muslims don't like Jews. They like the Jews even less than the English do. And so you end up with Rochdale. And then who did they elect? George Galloway, a flaming opponent of Israel. This is how God works in human history. And the point of us as rational creatures is to see that we, namely the Christians and the Muslims in England, where the Muslims are much more important, need to come together in some type of political alliance that will stop the Jewish hegemony that's destroying our culture.
And adopt a religion that actually protects and maintains the patriarchy, i.e. supports marriage. Because without patriarchy, Western men would be helpless to organize themselves in any way at all.
Let me give the analogy. It's the same thing in America. What England needs now is a moral consensus. The problem is that the Church of England can no longer provide this moral consensus. So you have to have a new institution that basically says that what Islam, what the Muslims and the Christians have in common is an adherence to the moral law, which means no abortion and no Zionism. That's the unifying factor. And I think that George Galloway's election is he's a left. I think he was a Catholic. I think he's ultimately a Catholic, but he's a leftist and all this other type of stuff has to be factored in. But I think this is the meaning of Galloway's election. And I think it's the task that England has to face right now. The same task that America has to face, where Muslims are not as significant as they are in England.
But surely if America adopted Sharia, then the rest of the West will just follow in America's wake and thereby deal with the divisions currently existing amongst Christians who cannot unite because they do not have codified principles, and therefore division will always happen when Christians even get together and say, can we even agree on what Christian principles are?
Yes, yes. No, we are not agreeing on Christian principles. We are agreeing on rational principles, which are completely independent of any religion, and that's called the natural law, or it's called the moral law. And we can have a consensus on that, and the proof is that America did have a consensus on that. So if you go back to Ralph Waldo Emerson, the Satanist, he was a good family man. And he lived next door to Nathaniel Hawthorne, who was a novelist, and he was a good family man. When was the last time that you had an American novelist who wasn't a drunk and an adulterer? Well, you have to go back to Nathaniel Hawthorne, where that moral consensus existed in the United States of America. And I'm saying if it existed once, it can exist again, because that's the only basis now. In a sense, every place is America. Europe is America now. Mm-hmm. England is America. We have to get back to this moral consensus,
which is to restore the patriarchy and to privilege married parents over non-parents.
I agree. I agree with you.
But free love and the culture of casual sex is so internalized, and indeed it's assumed to be a human right.
I agree with you.
The right to fornicate is.
I agree with you.
Yes.
And who said it was a human right? Who said that it's a fundamental right? The Jews have, and we have to hold them accountable for the role that they played in the corruption of sexual morality all throughout Europe and the United States. We have
or
to hold
you could
them
say the Jews working for the liberals.
Let me just say another thing that's even more important for England. There was a moral reform in England that took place over the course of the 18th and 19th centuries, and it was called Methodism. Okay, now Methodism has no legitimacy whatsoever as a religion, okay, but it was a great vehicle for moral reform, and it succeeded. If you look at the time of the Regency, like the early 19th century, you have nothing but sexual decadence epitomized by Lord Byron, if you want to have a paradigm for that. And mm-hmm. over that period of time, it changed. It changed in America and it changed in England. Gertrude Himmelfarb wrote a book about this. So it's a fact of life. So if Methodism was the thing that saved sexual morality in England, we have to go back to the same type of formula. It's basically, okay, moral reform. Is it possible to have moral reform without a religion? That's another
or
question.
Or repentance? Because we
look,
have to
there's groups called, you know, the Moral Rearmament Society. There are groups in Philadelphia. To think that you can have morality without religion is utopian. I do not believe that. I am not simply a utopian moralizer. I'm a Catholic. And if you want the best expression of the interpretation of the moral law, go to the Catholic Church. That's my position. But I am also talking about political alliances that are based on political principles, and the unifying political principle in the United States and England is the moral law, and it worked in both of those countries, and it can work again.
Yes, so social conservatism is the common feature that these allies would have to agree on.
Now, that's a term you can use, yeah, but I'm saying the moral law is what we're talking about here.
The sanctification of marriage.
Absolutely. You have to have the sanctity of marriage. You have to preserve the sanctity of marriage. Even Euripides understood this a long time before Christianity in the Bacchae. When the women leave their looms and go off on the mountainside and dance naked, worshiping Dionysus, society is over. That's the end of Thebes. That's the problem. And that's exactly what the Jews orchestrated during this cultural revolution or the sexual revolution of the 1960s.
Yes, I suppose it's a matter of changing the words, isn't it? I mean, you could blame the Jews, you could blame the liberals, you could blame Westerners if you're looking from it from, you know, outside the West. The sentence still makes sense. if you want to blame the Jews, or if you want to blame the Americans and liberals, the white people who, or Hollywood, who introduced the idea of sexual liberation from the rules of marriage and good parenting.
I'm not trying to exonerate everyone who committed a sexual sin during this period of time. The genius of sexual liberation is that you collaborate in your own enslavement. That's the genius. That's why it's the greatest form of sexual control, political control in human history. The second edition of Libido Dominandi will be coming out within a week or two, 2 weeks or three. I always get in trouble when I set a date, but it's going to be out soon. And this book, as its first chapter, has the story of the Israelis coming into Ramallah, taking over the TV stations and broadcasting pornography over Palestinian TV stations in 2004. That is the quintessential example of what I'm talking about. And it's not in the first edition because my book came out in 2003. So this was a complete vindication of my thesis, and now that story is in the second edition. But that's what we're talking about.
Wow. Well, I look forward to that very much, because fundamentally, I think what we have now is that there are no principled men, because if there were principled men, they would not submit to immoral women. And you can only define immoral women by their lack of chastity. And you can objectively identify them by noting that these immoral women would be unmarried mothers whom men are afraid to criticize.
Right. And so sexual liberation led to feminism as night leads to day. Okay, it was inevitable. Okay, and so if you're going to screw whomever you want, chances are the lady's going to get pregnant and you're not married to her, and that will lead to abortion, and that leads to total Jewish control of our culture. So it's all happened. But again, God is in charge of human history. A Muslim should be able to understand this. Okay, and so now you have Ireland waking up from that nightmare of sexual liberation and now refusing to redefine the family in the Constitution. They refuse to talk about partners instead of families and men and women. So the change is happening. It's happening.
Good, good. I hope there will be a pushback, because if they stop us from identifying as men or women, then we will not perform our gender roles. And right. That will lead to confusion and anger when we don't get what we want. Because, the whole point of performing gender roles to people who want to get married if you want to get married, you want to perform your gender roles to show, what a good catch you are as a man or a woman. But if you don't care to get married, then you would resent having to perform your gender roles.
Right.
I think Tote was
right in the book that started this discussion when he said that when the form collapses, you have violence. The form tells you how to behave. Okay. It's a lot of the times it's just so custom. It can't be custom anymore because the United States has destroyed all custom. That's the mission of the United States in the world. So at a certain point, you have to have a rational basis. And there is a rational basis, so you can do this. So it's not impossible. But in the meantime, what you have is violence. And so I compared the form is what holds things together. And so if you're talking about matter, it's the atom. And there's a form that holds us together. We know that it's not material. If you break that form, you split the atom, and when you split the atom, you have an incredibly destructive force that is being released. That's exactly what happened in the West when they split the nuclear family. That's why it's called that. When you break that bond between a man and a woman, you release violence, and England is an example of that. A message, a harbinger of what we're talking about here would be Clockwork Orange. When that film came out, the violence of the characterized sexuality at that point was one of the sequels of the sexual revolution. I'm saying that I did a book called Monsters from the Id, which talks about horror movies as a sequel of the sexual revolution. Alien is the sequel to Deep Throat. These are all things that we need to understand now on our way back to the understanding that the basis for our culture is the moral law. And you can't, we can differ in terms of our religious beliefs. I'm not trying to say they're all the same. I think obviously that Catholicism is superior to the other alternatives. Otherwise I wouldn't be a Catholic, but I'm saying that is not a political decision. And the political decision has to go back to the default setting, which is acceptance of the moral law as normative for everyone, including Jews, including Israelis. Okay, you cannot get a pass on the moral law. Sorry. If you do that, you are no longer a member of civilized society, and your government has no right to exist.
Talking about government, George Washington's farewell speech said, "We must, with caution, indulge the supposition that morality can be maintained without religion."
Absolutely right.
And I wanted to quote.
The American experiment, if you want to talk about that, did not abolish religion in the way the French Revolution did. So Americans were products of the Reformation. The American founder said, look, Ben Franklin's a classic example. Like, I can't solve that. I'm just going to give contributions to all the sects and hope that the one of them is right and I get into heaven by, you know, giving them money. But I'm not going to solve that problem. It's too deep. We're not going to suppress religion. We are not going to support any particular religion. We will let them all flourish on their own terms, but they have to all agree on the fundamental moral bedrock of this country. So I think I understand what Washington's saying, and I think that's been the struggle. Can we maintain this moral framework, which is essential to the preservation of the Republic? As of now, we'd have to answer, say, no, we failed.
Yes, but this problem is as old as the hills, because I can quote from you the Bhagavad Gita, and it says, "Out of the corruption of women proceeds the confusion of castes. Out of the confusion of castes, the loss of memory. Out of the loss of memory, the lack of understanding. And out of this, all evils."
That's a brilliant analysis of India. I think I have to, it's brilliant, okay? But India is a completely different situation. Completely different situation. India. That's a topic for another story.
Yes,
Let's wrap this up now. Wrap this up.
It's been such a pleasure. It's been such a pleasure, Mike, and I think we managed to cover new territory that you didn't cover with the others, perhaps, I like to think, anyway. Do you have any last words?
Claire, I think we did have a meeting of the minds. I think it was problematic in the past, but I think that Logos is rising, okay, and I think we are coming to a consensus. I think we've reached it today, and I think this is the consensus we have to come to. And I think it's matured over the time since I first met you to the point now where I think we're having productive conversations. So thank you. Thank you for having me.
And thank you so much for coming. Thank you, Mr. Jones. Bye.